Work takes up most of your time. That's why you should use Stamps.com to save time with your mailing and shipping, and have flexibility to focus on more important things. Stamps.com can handle all your mailing and shipping needs with rates up to 88% off USPS and UPS. Add flexibility to your day with Stamps.com. Go to stamps.com/program to sign up for a special offer. No contract, cancel anytime. That's stamps.com/program.
Wow, what's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Please enjoy this episode from the Dressed Archive. We will be back with Season 8 and all new Dressed content in February 2025.
With over 7 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts. I am Cassidy Zachary.
And I am April Callahan. So today, Dressed listeners, we are rejoined by Dr. Ariane Fenteau for part two of our conversation about tie-on pockets as they were worn by women during the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries.
And while these types of pockets are a far cry from the types of sewn-in pockets we have today, tie-on pockets were staples of European and American women's wardrobes for centuries, and their wear spanned class and economic status. And we are so pleased to welcome Dr. Fenteau back to learn more.
Ariane, welcome back to the show. Last episode, we left off discussing some of the decorative motifs and embellishments that were used on pockets. And we will hear a little bit more about how in this episode, how the intimate nature of pockets were both used and viewed at this time. So, Ariane, welcome back. I think it might be surprising to our listeners that most women owned several pair of pockets. Why several pair?
Okay, so why several pairs of pockets? First, because you could have different... The first purpose is that when a pair of pockets gets dirty, then you have a change of pockets, just like you have a change of shift or a change of underclothes. And any linen came in pairs, really, or dozens of pairs, really. And a classic example is a story that is told in a newspaper, I think, of a woman who has put a puppy in her pocket, and then her pocket, the puppy does his business in his pocket, in her pockets, and she has to ask the servant to go and fetch a fresh pair. So obviously, like, it could come in handy to have more than one pair. Another reason is also that they could come in different types of finish. So there's an interesting novel we looked at, which is called Grandmama's Pockets, and it's a Victorian novel. And in it, there is the main protagonist is this grandmother who's got different pairs of pockets. And the other protagonist is the granddaughter, Annie, and she's fascinated by her grandmother's pockets. And the grandmother explains that she's got different pockets for different occasions as well. So she'll have the grand pockets for grand occasions and the more practical, mundane pockets that she'll wear more in a sort of everyday basis.
Uh-huh.
And you could also decide to match or not match. You could have one in the wash and one in use. So it made practical sense to have different pairs.
Mm-hmm.
Some women had not just three pairs in inventories. You find women like the most pockets one woman had, and that's not necessarily the most that any woman could have. That's the most that we found evidence for, is 18 pairs of pockets. So that's quite a lot.
Yeah. And one thing that is like our entire conversation hasn't addressed, but it's begging this question, what types of objects were women carrying in their pockets? What were some of the more common objects that women were carrying in their pockets? Because, of course, we're talking about them being worn across all sorts of class strata here.
The contents of pockets is something that is obviously quite fascinating. They are bulky. The pockets are, compared to our modern day pockets, when we do have pockets, they are enormous. So you can carry quite a lot, especially if you have a pair or if you wear more than a pair, which women could do. Obviously, you can decide to wear two pairs or three pairs if you wanted to. But even if you just had one, just so that your listeners have a visual of what we're talking about. We're talking about something that on average is about 40 centimeters deep, 30 centimeters across. And the biggest pair of pockets we have is one that is 60 centimeters deep and 45 centimeters across. And it comes in a pair. So you could carry extraordinary amounts of things, both in terms of bulk and in terms of weight. That leads to some unusual things to carry in pockets, like live ducks. Instance, we have a woman who tries to steal two ducks, presumably one in each pocket. I don't think we could fit a duck or even a duckling in our modern day pockets. So that kind of gives you an impression of how big they could be. But obviously, ducks is not the things you find most commonly in women's pockets every time. More common obviously is money. Money is a big thing that you find. Also, other items of clothing. That's another interesting finding, which is that obviously women's clothing, especially in the 18th century, was made up of all these different parts. So your cuffs could come apart. Your neckerchief was another layer. And often these removable parts or adjustable parts were something that you could store in your pocket or keep in your pockets mm-hmm. when they got removed because you were warm or because it was inappropriate to wear this in the current circumstances where you were. So other items of clothing, also jewelry is one thing that's interesting because jewelry acted both as adornment, you know, a little bit like the removable parts of your dress. You know, are you going to be wearing the earrings or are you not going to be wearing the earrings? But also jewelry was transformable into cash. It was a sort of property, a valuable property that could be carried and that you may want, whether or not you were right. Obviously, we look at court cases, so we look at cases when the pockets failed a little bit, but women presumably put jewelry in their pockets to try and safeguard the jewelry, thinking that the pocket would be the safest place to store and keep at hand their valuable belongings. You find also other containers, and that's another interesting finding that we came across, which is that the pocket is a container and it often contains other containers, which themselves were contained into other containers. And we noticed this kind of nesting of containers, a little bit like a box of Chinese nests.
Yeah.
Where women would wrap their coins in a handkerchief, put the handkerchief in the box in a purse and the purse in the pocket as a kind of ritual of protection of whatever they had. Obviously, there's the obvious book. Paper-based things, books, letters, although these, when you look at the Old Bailey, for instance, they are often thought to have no value in the eyes of the court. They're not always listed in the indictment, in the kind of official list of the things that were lost, but they often come in the testimonies when women explain, I had this, but also there was also this ballad in my pocket or this letter I had. Obviously, we don't know what was in the letter. When they say a book of memorandum, was this just notes or was this an actual diary? This is difficult tell from the old Bailey, but from other sources, we know, for instance, that women did keep their diaries in their pockets, or some women did anyway.
And you said that a lot of times the paper-based objects didn't necessarily have, quote-unquote, monetary value assigned to them. But in the instance of duplicates, which I thought was fascinating, these really did have monetary value. So what were duplicates and why were they important?
So duplicates are really, that's another really interesting thing that surprised us to some extent. So duplicates, basically, there are the receipts that the pawnbroker would give you when you went to pawn an article. So it's basically a paper receipt. But this paper receipt held the possibility of the value of the object it stood for. And a lot of poorer women in particular actually used pawning as a way of managing their resources, both in terms of pawning, because you have to imagine that women lived in really insecure accommodation. Most poorer women lived in shared accommodation, sometimes shared room. So they had no room of their own. They had no cupboard of their own. They had nothing to store their belongings. And even something meager, even if it's not gold, or even if it's a hat or your best gown, you would sometimes you use the pawnbroker in a way as a storage facility, where something where you think your belongings would be safe, and in exchange, so they wouldn't be stolen, you would have your pawn ticket or duplicates to show for it, and you can go and retrieve your object with the duplicates. And but obviously, for other women, it was also a way of regulating your cash, your budget. So like you're short of money at the end of the month, so you'll raise money by putting your objects into pawn. With that money, you can maybe buy a little stock of something, sell it, make a profit, and from the profit, you can go and redeem your object. And what's fascinating about the duplicates is sometimes you can see just by how many women kept in their pockets that for some women, it was a way of living. It was their source of income, in a way, was these duplicates. Some women, they described their, not, I wouldn't say their job, but their, how do you make a living? I make a living by selling a few things and pawning. So this was a way of, in a way, making ends meet. And it's interesting because, as you said, the duplicates, although they are just a piece of paper, they are recognized in the eyes of a court as having the money that's written on them. So what we found is that, in a way, one of the sort of big ideas about currency is that coins disappear and that you have the banknotes that arise. We didn't find so many banknotes in women's pockets, but what we found was this currency of salt. The duplicates, which is, it's a kind of bill in a way. It is a kind of currency. It is recognized by the court as currency. Say, we know that it's just a piece of paper, but behind that piece of paper is a silk gown, for instance. And the silk gown is worth a few pounds. So it's something.
Absolutely. And also, too, given that the court records were one of the major sources within the book, it's not a surprise then that there is a lot of discussion of pockets in the context of thefts, right? Because that was like the dialogue that was happening back and forth. We see the theft of pockets, theft by pockets, which you have already referenced in context of the ducks. But it doesn't seem to be like terribly uncommon that women were being robbed of their pockets. So my question to you is, how did this happen? Because we've already established the fact that these were very intimate garments. These were tied about your waist and they're worn under your skirts. So how was this occurring?
Pickpockets were now and then very gifted at penetrating in a way the different layers of women's garments to try and get to the pocket. There's actually an interesting sort of autobiography of a pickpocket who discusses the difference, the most favorable position for the pocket to be in, to be attacked, whether, because obviously the pocket could be worn at different depths in your different sandwich of clothing, in between the first petticoat, the second petticoat, over your hoops or under your hoops, and you could decide where you would wear them. But pickpockets had different techniques. Because they're detached, if they're hanging, say, on your hoops, you wouldn't really feel them against your thighs. So what a thief can do is just lift your sack, that is the outer gown, up and access your pockets. What they did was sometimes cut the string of the pocket. Sometimes they cut a slit at the bottom of the pocket to get the contents out. And some thieves are found because they have blood on their hands, because obviously the end of the knife has backfired on them and they cut themselves. And this is how somebody gets found, because the woman's going to say, well, I noticed he had blood on his hand. And then I turned back and I noticed that my pocket was empty and it had a big slit in it. And sometimes it's pure force. Sometimes they're not even trying to do it stealthily. They just, you know, grab you, pull your skirt up and pull at the whole pocket, wrenching the whole pocket off your body to get everything, rather than put your hand in your pocket to try and get whatever's in it. So yes, they were quite brazen.
Yeah. We're going to take another brief sponsor break, but more with Dr. Fenato when we come back. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Dressed listeners, the new year is upon us, and with the annual refresh of our calendars, so too comes our personal list of New Year's resolutions. And if you're anything like me, every year that includes contributing more to my investment and savings accounts. But as the months go by and expenses arise and opportunities appear, I don't always meet my savings goals.
Which is why we want to remind you about Acorns. You've heard us mention Acorns before because they make it easy to start automatically saving and investing so your money has a chance to grow for you, your kids, and your retirement.
You don't need to be an expert. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that fits you and your money goals. You also don't need to be rich. Acorns lets you invest with the spare money you've got now. You can start with $5 or even just your spare change.
Financial wellness is not impossible. Acorns gives you small, simple steps to get you and your money a chance to grow and keep you on track with your savings and investment goals. Head to acorns.com/stressed or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today.
Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/stressed.
Menopause, perimenopause, these can be some of the most uncomfortable phases of a woman's life. If you find yourself in either of these, well, Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it really shows.
And get this, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it is perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold.
And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that.
Yeah.
No hassle.
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome back. We're talking about the intimate nature of the pocket being layered within a woman's dress or layers of her dress. But I'm also sure that some of these purloined items were probably of a private nature in and of themselves, the things that were stolen. I'm wondering if you can speak to the role of the pocket in a woman's personal life, because in the book, you and Barbara note, and I'm quoting you two, quote, "Women's control over this small space was hard won and fragile, and even the pocket could never guarantee women an undisputed experience of privacy."
Pockets are really interesting in relation to privacy, because women did not necessarily have a place of their own. They did not necessarily have, even elite women, who we tend to think of as having their little closet and having their little boudoirs where they can retreat and write their letters. That's not really that true. Even elite women, we know, like Jane Austen, she didn't really have a place of her own or a room of her own. She wrote in the sitting room, hiding a little bit from her relatives. And Fanny Burney, another kind of published author, part of the elite, she's part of this woman who keeps the last page of a diary in her pocket as a kind of letter. And then she either copies or attaches that page to the rest of the diary. And earlier on in her diary writing, she tells of an incident of losing the last page of her diary because she's gone to write in her father's study because she doesn't have a study. So he has the desk, and so she goes to use the desk. And this is how she loses the last page of the diary, which obviously she's really embarrassed about being 17. So even elite women did not necessarily have private spaces they actually controlled. So a woman's pocket could often act as the only potential place to experience privacy, something that at least was kept in the direct vicinity of the body. At night, women had the habit of putting the pocket under the pillow, very much as you do when you're traveling, for instance. I don't know whether your listeners are, so in the old days of traveling anyway, go to hostels or take night trains. But I remember when I was doing my traveling as a teenager, in night trains, you would be told to put your pocket, or not your pocket, but your bag with your passport and everything under your pillow, thinking mm-hmm. this is the safest place. I feel it at night if somebody tries to pinch it. So the pocket was, yes, detachable, but also very companionate, intimate object that women always had about their bodies. And obviously this endows the pocket with intimacy already, because even it's in its very fibers, the pocket would be imbibed with the sense of the warmth of the body, the scent of the body. So it's a very intimate object. But intimate doesn't necessarily mean private. And keeping the privacy of the pocket intact was not always easy, because pockets were accessed only with the hand, not with the eyes. You had to navigate the different layers of your clothing to access your pocket and its different contents only through your hand. And obviously when you pull something out, something else might drop, for instance, which is what happened to Fanny Burney. So they're not completely sealed. They're not completely immune from either an accident or somebody's prying fingers and eyes.
Yeah.
And they're often a place where, say, jealous husbands or suspicious fathers might want to look if they're suspecting any private correspondence or any untoward happenings. The pocket was an obvious space to investigate.
Yeah, and I thought that was really, especially that the pocket as being the site of external suspicion, was that whole concept played out in a really interesting way when you write about the fact that a lot of girls' schools during this time period did not let their students wear pockets because they were acknowledging that these could be instruments of secrecy.
I guess it's a separate place, isn't it? It's a pocket. Always, it's the possibility of secrecy. It's not necessarily secrecy guaranteed or privacy guaranteed, but it opens up the the possibility of secrecy or of hiding something. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in institutional settings like schools or prisons or workhouses, that possibility is always dangerous, right?
Yeah.
Because you don't know what women might harbor in that possibility of a private space. So that tend to be either very closely monitored or banned or not part of the uniforms.
Yeah. Also, in the context of court records, you also note many instances where the contents of a woman's pocket were used in the context of criminal investigations. But one I would like to talk about is perhaps most notably to identify Catherine Eddowes, who was one of the victims of Jack the Ripper in 1888. What types of items were found on her, and what was the importance of pockets to women who were in similar circumstances to Catherine?
So Catherine Eddowes, she's one of the victims of Jack the Ripper. She is not the only one that had pockets. Out of all the victims, there's about five that for whom we have precise coroner's descriptions of what they were wearing, and therefore we know whether or not they had pockets. And I think three of those at least had time pockets. But Catherine Eddowes is by far the most detailed in the records we have of what she had. And I think she is very emblematic of poorer London women, women just trying. There's Jack the Ripper victims have often been described as prostitutes. They weren't prostitutes. They were just women trying to make ends meet. Catherine Woman did not prostitute herself. She was not selling her body. She had a partner. She was just living in really unstable, challenging circumstances in London, just doing bits and pieces to try and keep body and soul together, really. And the pockets that she had, when she was found, she had two pairs of pockets, and then other garments that she was wearing had also pockets. So she had quite a lot of containers about her. And I'm really quite touched by the Catherine Eddowes, because this woman was just struggling. Mm-hmm. She was just struggling, but she was trying to maintain a dignity. She was trying to maintain a living. She was trying to keep her life going despite very difficult circumstances. And the pockets were part of that resilience. And they played a part in collecting the bits and pieces that would allow her to keep up her appearance, for instance. So she had little pieces of soap. It's interesting, the contents of her pockets, there's nothing that's whole. Everything is a fragment of or a piece of. So she's got pieces of soap. She's got a bit of tobacco. She's got tea and sugar in a little tin box. And we know from different pieces in the investigation that the story is that her and her partner were trying to get money by going hop picking in Essex, but they didn't get any work hop picking. So they came back to London really with no money whatsoever, not knowing where they're going to spend the night. And he pawns his boots so that they can at least have some breakfast. And so in her pocket, you find the tea and the sugar that they had bought for that breakfast, as well as the pawn ticket for his shoes. And this is how actually she gets identified. It's through that pawn ticket. And you really see her, of course, in the end, failed strategy to keep it together. But it's not in a way because it failed that the strategy wasn't there. You can see, so she's also got little pieces of rag that she's probably collected to sell to the rag and bone man. You can see, there's something about keeping her appearance. There's a comb. There's the soap I mentioned. There's the tobacco. It's November. She gets found in November. You've got to keep, sustain yourself with something. So her story is really touching.
Yeah.
Because you can see that hardship and you can see the strategies and you can see that her belongings are meager, very humble, and then fragmented, but they're still organized. So it's not the same type of belonging that's in this pocket to the ones that are in that other pocket. So she's organizing her world, whatever that consists of, in among or across the different containers to try and, yeah, keep an order, keep her life together. And I find this quite touching.
Yeah. And also, too, it could definitely be argued that pockets were very much used to aid a woman's mobility through navigating the urban landscape, right? And it's some of the accounts, not just hers, but some of the other ones that you go into, really detail how a lot of these women who were in these really challenging circumstances were using their pockets to carry just about every physical belonging that they had.
Yeah, because women did not have safe accommodation. They did not really have somewhere where they could lock it up, whatever they had up, and go about. They carried what they had. And obviously, some women wore different petticoats to keep warm, but also to put them somewhere safe or as safe as possible. And it's the same with the pockets. Like, you keep everything you have in your pockets because that's as safe as it's going to get. And it allows you to move places. And obviously, for people in challenging circumstances, that mobility is going to be key because it's going to give you the adaptability, the flexibility to go to Kent or to go to Essex and then come back to maybe try that lodging house, find that they're full, go to this other lodging house with your everything, your little world around you or about you. So that, and it's the same with servants, for instance. Servants is an occupation that you find obviously many women engaged in, where mobility is really important because you're, although you're trying to find a place, so in a way, you're trying to find somewhere where you're not going to be moving, you're a position, somewhere you're stable. Really, the life of service was a life of mobility, forced or not. Even once you were in a position, you still had to run around. And so that pockets were really important because they are portable. You can carry quite a lot, whether it's your belongings or your mistress's belongings, to, and it leaves your hands free. So it is an instrument of mobility and freedom, even if this is to try and stay afloat in challenging circumstances.
So definitely less macabre than Catherine Eddowes' story, but perhaps no less heartbreaking or touching is also the story of Margaret Dees. Who was Margaret Dees? And can you tell us a little bit about a pocket that she created for Annie Stirling in 1851?
So this is one of my favorites. So basically, this is a pocket that is a tiny pocket. It's only a few, it's about 10 centimeters tall. So it's a miniature pocket rather than a functional pocket. And it's fascinating because it was made by this woman called Margaret Dees, who is an inmate in a Glasgow prison. And what is fascinating about it is not so much its size, but the fact that it's embroidered in the woman's, we assume, what is her own hair. And it's embroidered in this sentimental motto that says, "Forget me not." And then her name, Margaret Dees. And it was made by this inmate in the prison and given as a gift to the governor's wife, Annie Stirling. Now, unfortunately, we do not know what happened to Margaret Dees after she gave that pocket, whether the forget-me-not was related to anything tragic for her, whether she was deported or she was sentenced or she was just leaving the prison and she didn't want to be forgotten. But obviously, it's a very touching story because of what we were discussing before as well. She is in this prison, and we know the prison, we've made some research about the prison, and we know that this is a prison that was implementing the kind of Jeremy Bentham's idea of a panopticon, a prison where everything is supposed to be visible, you're supposed to see into the cells, and inmates are under constant supervision and a constant gaze. So there's this kind of scopic dream or nightmare in place in that prison. Obviously, having a small pocket, even if it's made potentially under the supervision of the governor's wife, because we know that sometimes there were educational things or projects made with inmates. We know that creating that space is potentially always subversive, you know, what she could put, although it's small, she could still put something in that pocket. She could still create a space that is her own, whether or not in a way she puts anything in it, she's still creating a space of her own.
This is a very intimate story, right? She is making this pocket. She is embroidering it with her own hair. So there's this level of intimacy and sentimentality to this story that I'd like to parlay into pointing out that pockets were often made for friends, relatives, and they were often given as gifts. So why was it that pockets were viewed as a token of friendship?
That's an interesting question and points, really. So relationship between pockets and friendship, which could work in two ways, because you could make pockets for friends or relatives. You could give your pocket to a friend in your will or receive a pocket of your friend in a will. But pockets, because they're also harbored small objects that could be sentimental in nature, because they were companionate objects which held other companionate things, they also formed this kind of very feminine space, a sort of space for inter-female relationships, because friends would give each other little things to put in each other's pockets, like symbols or handkerchiefs or passes that they had made for each other. So, and it's something that is, when people say, yeah, men also had pockets, and yes, men had pockets, but they didn't make their own pockets. And I don't think there was this traffic of femininity or female things as much, or of male things as much in men's pockets. I think there's something very specific about the femininity of that space, mm-hmm. and how both in its exterior and in its interior, it was for women, by women, through other women. And it's maybe why it was seen as also threatening, because it was a space that men had very little to do with.
Yeah. So eventually, as we transition into the tail end of the 19th century and into the 20th century, we start to see the popularity of tie-on pockets dissipate slowly. Didn't happen overnight. But my question to you is, do you think that this has anything to do with the increasing use of handbags?
The question of the famous question of handbags and pockets, another question that's puzzled us all through the writing of the book. I'd say that this is not a new question. The question of handbags and pockets is not something that suddenly appears in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Handbag, or a handheld bag, although it wasn't called a handbag, but it was a bag held in the hand, had been there since the 17th century. Women had gaming bags, had work bags, had different bags that they carried in their hand. Mm. In the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century, you obviously have the reticule, the small purse, outside purse, that is supposed or seen by dress historian often as the first handbag. That if you listen to the press, if you listen to the fashion press of the time, just eradicates the tie-on pockets. The traditional narrative was that women had pockets in the 18th century, then the reticule appeared and pockets were out. And then women had the reticule and then they had the handbag. What we found is that although the press said, you are old-fashioned, you carry on wearing pockets any respectable young fashionable woman will want to reticule these days. That's not really what women did. So that was a fascinating insight, that what the press was telling women to do about what is fashionable, what is appropriate, wasn't necessarily what women actually did. Mm. Fashion and dress practices are not always the same, and women are not necessarily swayed by the latest fad saying, oh, abandon your pockets, they're unfashionable, because pockets were called unfashionable for at least half of their lives. They're just in discourses cast as old-fashioned, unfashionable, the kind of accessory of doddering old women, whereas the handbag or the reticule is supposed to be the modern new thing. So that's not a new thing. That, you know, that's not a new sort of contrast or a new debate. I think what changes in the 19th century is not necessarily the handbag so much, but maybe more the fact that women start working in more in the same types of jobs, or not really the same types, but they have more careers in offices, in jobs where at the end of the 19th century, you start having more tailored suits for women. So it's also the people making women's clothes that change, and it starts being more tailors. And tailors had always been used to making pockets, inserting pockets for men. So I'm not sure it's the handbag really that's displaced or overthrown the pockets. Mm. I think it's a combination of factors, but it's very difficult to explain why something appears and why something disappears.
Yeah.
Why did pockets end?
Yeah. And on that same note, a lot of the listener requests that we've gotten for an episode on pockets have come to us with this question of asserting that modern day women's clothing has less frequently pockets than men's clothing. So it could be argued yes, it could be argued no. I'm curious, as obviously you and Barbara have thought extensively on the topic of pockets, much more so than many people. I'm curious to know if you have any thoughts on this. Do modern day women's clothing contain less pockets? And if so, what does that mean?
So my answer is yes. Modern day clothes, women's clothes are notorious in lacking pockets, from fake pockets in jeans to no pockets in dresses or skirts, and then pockets in jeans that are supposed to be a unisex type of garment that you probably, your listeners will know, but probably the study that was done by the website The Pudding measuring the average size of pockets in different brands, American brands of jeans, for men and for women, and finding that the average women's jeans pocket is, I can't remember how many inches shorter and narrower than the equivalent in the same brand for men, and what objects you can and cannot fit in this or that pocket or brand, whether you can fit your iPhone or not your iPhone. So yes, obviously there is a pocket question, a pocket equality question at the moment. What's interesting, though, is that this question of the kind of inferiority of women's pockets in relation to men's pockets was not really a question, was not really raised until the pockets we're talking about in the book disappeared. Mm. Now, you could be provocative a little bit and say that, because there is an interesting dovetailing of issues between the women's suffrage, women getting the vote, so the suffragist movement, and a moment at the end of the 19th century when women don't really have as much the town pockets that we described, but they don't really have real pockets either. So they're in a kind of no pocket zone. And there is a layering of the discourses about having pockets and having the suffrage. And there's even a funny text using all the anti-suffrage rhetoric that was used at the time, using it as if it was written about pockets. And why should women not be given pockets? Just like you had the rhetoric, why should not women be given the vote? So there's an interesting kind of correlation between women getting the vote, enfranchisement, and having pockets or modern day pockets. And even later, when women did get the vote in Britain anyway, or some women did get the vote in Britain, Gwen Reverett, who's the granddaughter of Charles Darwin, and who's an artist, and she's got a really nice piece where she remembers her childhood. And she says, oh, in those days, we had pockets. And I remember everything I put in my pockets. And she lists all the wonderful hoards that she could only fit in those really big pockets and not in the pockets of, you know, 19th Britain or contemporary Western world. Anyway, it ends with, we have suffrage, but why can't we have pockets? If you want to be provocative, you could say that it's interesting that in a way, the bulky, very capacious pockets that we're describing arrived at a time when women were given the right to private property in their own name and were given suffrage. So is it payback? Is it payback for taking the pockets away? Is this your blood money for a sort of retaliation for other powers or empowering tools? The suffrage or accessing property in your own right. But we're not pushing that argument in the book. I'm just playing with the idea.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This was incredibly fascinating. This episode is going to make a ton of people super, super happy. It's only been 4 seasons in the making. So thank you so much, Dr. Fenneteau, for joining us. And we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you once again, Ariane, for joining us for this fascinating 2-part episode.
Yeah, and Cass, on that last note about the pockets evolution and connection to the suffrage movement, I'd also just like to mention an essay which Ariane and Barbara reference in the book. And it was an essay written in 1895 by none other than one of the leaders of the American suffrage movement, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And this essay was entitled "The Pocket Problem." So clearly, many of our modern day consternations regarding pockets and women's garments, they were shared by our counterparts more than 125 years ago.
And our interview with Dr. Fenneteau only scratches the surface of many of these issues. If you'd like to learn more, we highly recommend picking up a copy of The Pocket, A Hidden History of Women's Lives, 1660 to 1900, as there is just so much more to say on the topic, not to mention the wonderful images that are in this book of some of the 400 pairs of extant tie and pockets, which they examined in the course of their research. Some of them are just sublimely beautiful. This book is incredible. I highly recommend
it. Yes, and I vote we all just start wearing tie-on pockets again. And then I was thinking about this, and then I was like, oh, Cass and I already do. I don't know if we've talked about this. I think we maybe briefly mentioned this on the show before, but you have been a really big fan of fanny packs.
Oh, yeah.
Or as they're called in the UK, bum bags, for quite a while. And it was only finally this summer that I converted to them because I was riding my bike everywhere because it was still COVID and I didn't want to take the subway in New York City during the middle of the pandemic. And so now I get it. It is so easy and convenient to have your hands free. So if you think about it, fanny pack, bum bags, there have been a lot of ways this modern day incarnation of tie-on pockets.
Yeah, and if you want to be a little more literal, dress listeners, you'll probably remember from our interview last week with Christine of At So Steamed that there are a lot of historical costumers and dressmakers who are making renditions or their own versions of these historical tie-on pockets. So you too can participate in the tie-on pocket trend that April and I are voting for to start back.
Bring immediately. Back.
That does it for our 2-part episode on a history of the pocket, dress listeners. May you consider the political implications of the pocket next time you get dressed.
Dressed will be back with season 8 and all brand new episodes in February of next year. But until then,
remember, we love hearing from you. So if you would like to write to us, you can do so at hello@dressedhistory.com. Dressedhistory.com is also where, of course, you can register for our tours, our trips, our new class,
anything else that we have up our finely tailored sleeves.
That includes April's twice weekly in-person fashion history tours at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, as well as our brand new Dress the School of Fashion live online course, the 1950s Golden Age Haute Couture, which is now open for registration. And we do have gift cards available for both April's tours and the class. So just send us an email at hello@dressedhistory.com. And also send us an email if you want to get on the first to know list for our New York City Day Tours coming your way in April 2025 and our Paris Fashion History Tours coming your way in June. Registration for both of these tours will open in January, and we do expect them to sell out. So send us an email to get on those lists.
Thank you, as always, for your continued support. Dressed will be coming back your way for Season 8 in early February. Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.